Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn and Anna Mateo. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, President Donald Trump wrote on Twitter Monday that he has the absolute right as President of the United States to pardon himself. Trump also criticized the U.S. Justice Department for deciding to appoint a special counsel to investigate possible wrongdoing in the 2016 elections. The president wrote, "As has been stated by numerous legal scholars, I have the absolute right to pardon myself, but why would I do that when I have done nothing wrong?" He added, "The appointment of the special counsel is totally unconstitutional. Despite that, we play the game because I, unlike the Democrats, have done nothing wrong." Trump's comments came a day after his lawyer, former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani, said the president could pardon himself. Giuliani's comment is similar to a memo published by the New York Times from his lawyers to special counsel Robert Mueller. The letter claimed that Trump could, if he wished, terminate the inquiry or even exercise his power to pardon if he so desired. Last May, the Justice Department named Mueller, a former head of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, as special counsel. He and his team are investigating whether Russia and Trump's presidential election campaign worked together to influence the 2016 vote. Mueller has since charged several people connected to the Trump campaign. Others admitted guilt in court to making false statements to the FBI. The special counsel also brought charges against 13 Russians and three Russian companies with plotting to interfere in the election. The issue of presidential pardons has been raised in recent weeks. The U.S. Constitution says the president shall have power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, except in cases of impeachment. Since taking office, Trump has approved pardons for several people who are not connected to the Mueller investigation. The moves and his comments led to a question whether he can actually pardon himself. Brian Cult is a legal expert with the Michigan State University College of Law. He wrote about this subject in the 1990s during congressional efforts to remove President Bill Clinton from office. Cult said James Wilson, a founding father of the U.S., indirectly raised the issue at the 1787 Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia. Cult wrote that when the question of potential presidential self-dealing through the pardon power had been raised, Wilson had argued the president was not above the law. As such, the pardon power could not protect him as it had England's King Charles II. The exact question of self-pardoning was not directly settled by the convention's delegates. However, Cult noted that self-pardons either were not considered or thought to be unacceptable. In the end, presidents cannot pardon themselves, he wrote. Judge Richard Posner wrote in a 1999 book about the Clinton case that the question was left open by the Founding Fathers. It has generally been inferred from the breadth of the constitutional language that the president can indeed pardon himself, Posner argued. Samuel Morrison once worked for the Justice Department as a lawyer and specialized in pardons. Last May, he told the Washington Post that a self-pardon could theoretically be done by a president. He said, "My opinion is that in theory that he could, but then he would be potentially subject to impeachment for doing that." Morrison added that there is nothing in the Constitution itself that says he can't do that.
The Thailand beach, made famous in the Leonardo DiCaprio film, The Beach, is being closed to give it a break from tourists. The beach sits on Maya Bay on Phiphilay Island, off the coast of Thailand in the Andaman Sea. The government ordered that no visitors will be permitted to go to the bay from June through September 2018. Thai officials say the decision is aimed at giving the area's coral reefs and sea life a chance to recover. Tourism officials say up to 5,000 visitors travel to the beach every day. Ton Tamrang Nawasawat is an ocean scientist and member of a government committee on environmental development. He told the Associated Press the closure is needed to help the beach heal. "It's like someone who has been working for decades and has never stopped," he said. "Overworked and tired, all the beauty of the beach is gone. We need a timeout for the beach." Maya Bay was used as the main filming area for the 2000 movie The Beach. It starred Leonardo DiCaprio as an American traveling through Asia with friends. The group is given a map that promises to lead them to paradise on Earth. The film showed the world the bay's beautiful white sandy beaches and bright blue waters. Many of Thailand's ocean national parks are closed from mid-May to mid-October. But high tourist demand led officials to keep Maya Bay open the whole year. Recent studies by ocean biologists found a large part of coral reefs in the area had disappeared. Most sea life was also gone. Ton had urged the government to close the area to visitors for many years. He said he thinks the action should have been taken at least 10 years ago. "But, you know, in Thailand, we are a tourism industry country. And we need a lot of money. So before, not so many people listened." A Thai official in the tourist area of Phuket told Reuters the closing of Maya Bay was one way to protect part of the country's natural beauty, which will be important for tourism in the future. But some local people are not completely happy. The head of the PP Tourist Business Association, Watrapol Yantaro, said he was surprised when the closure was announced. He said he and others in the area thought Maya Bay would only be closed to boats, while visitors would still be permitted to walk to the beach from the other side of the island. We are not against protecting our environment, Watrapol said. We know full well that Maya Bay is our important resource, like a rice field to a farmer. But we wish there were more communications about the government's plan before the decision was made. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. An outbreak of a brain-destroying virus is currently happening in the Kerala state of India. The number of people who have died from Nipah is relatively small. Officials from India's Ministry of Health and Family Welfare said in a statement to the press that this is not a major outbreak and is only a local occurrence. They cannot confirm the origin of the outbreak, but they can confirm that it is spreading between humans. So far, the Nipah virus has killed more than a dozen people. The victims include a 31-year-old nurse in Kerala. Lini Puthusari was part of a team treating the first Nipah patients. She was also a wife and the mother of two young children. Her body was cremated quickly so the infection would not spread. Health officials are most concerned about the high mortality rate of the disease. The World Health Organization lists the Nipah virus as a developing disease that could cause a global pandemic. Ebola and Zika are also on this list. Those who contract Nipah show signs of the disease quickly. Early signs include fever, sleepiness, vomiting, and mental confusion. An infected person may also suffer from a cough or have difficulty breathing. As the disease progresses, signs often include uncontrollable shaking and encephalitis, or swelling of the brain. Experts at the WHO say these symptoms can progress to a coma within 24 to 48 hours. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in the United States explains on its website that transmission of Nipah virus to humans may occur after direct contact with infected bats, infected pigs, or from other NIV-infected people. The WHO includes all animals in its explanation. Nipah virus can be transmitted to humans from animals, such as bats or pigs, or contaminated foods, and can also be transmitted directly from human to human. The CDC explains that the Nipah virus is named for a village in Malaysia. Nipah was first discovered there in 1999. At that time, the virus mostly infected pig farmers and those who had contact with pigs. At least 300 people in Malaysia and Singapore were infected, and more than 100 people died. The CDC adds that to control that outbreak, officials killed more than 1 million pigs. In this outbreak, bats infected pigs, and then pigs infected humans. There was no occurrence of person-to-person transmission in this outbreak. However, in Bangladesh and India, the CDC states that person-to-person transmission is regularly reported. Its site adds that this is most commonly seen in the family and caregivers of Nipah virus-infected patients. In this area, people can also get Nipah from contact with infected bats. The Science News website reports that there was a Nipah outbreak in Bangladesh from 2001 to 2007. People caught the disease after drinking contaminated fruit fluids that virus-carrying bats had also drank. There is no cure for Nipah or vaccine to protect against it. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The years after World War I were an important turning point in the making of the American nation. The country turned away from the problems of Europe. Now, it would deal with problems of its own. Kay Gallant and Morris Joyce tell about the many changes in America during the early 1920s.
There was a presidential election in America in 1920. President Woodrow Wilson was not a candidate. He had suffered a stroke and was too sick. The two major candidates were Democrat James Cox and Republican Warren Harding. Voters had a clear choice between the two candidates. Cox supported the ideas of President Wilson. He believed the United States should take an active part in world affairs. Harding opposed the idea of internationalism. He believed the United States should worry only about events within its own borders. Warren Harding won the election. By their votes, Americans made clear they were tired of sacrificing lives and money to solve other people's problems. They just wanted to live their own lives and make their own country a better place.
This was a great change in the nation's thinking. For 20 years since the beginning of the century, the United States had become more involved in international events. Young Americans had grown up with presidents like Woodrow Wilson and Theodore Roosevelt. Both Wilson and Roosevelt had active foreign policies. Both helped start the nation on the road to becoming a major world power. Then came World War I. It was like a sharp needle that burst a balloon. The United States and the Allies won the war against Germany and the Central Powers. But thousands of American troops had died in the European conflict, and many months were taken up by the bitter debate over the peace treaty and the League of Nations. Most Americans did not want to hear about Europe and international peace organizations anymore.
Instead, Americans became more concerned with material things. During World War I, they had lived under many kinds of restrictions. The federal government had controlled railroads, shipping, and industrial production. At the end of the war, these controls were lifted. Industries that had been making war supplies began making products for a peacetime economy. Wages for most workers in the United States were higher than ever at the beginning of the 1920s. Men and women had enough money to enjoy life more than they had in the past.
Technology made it possible for millions of people to improve their lives. It also caused great changes in American society. Two of the most important new technologies were automobiles and radio. In the early years of the 20th century, automobiles were very costly. Each one was built separately by a small team of skilled workers. Most Americans did not have the money to own an automobile. Then Henry Ford decided to make cars everyone could buy. He built them on an assembly line. Cars were put together or assembled as they moved slowly through the factory. Each worker did just one thing to the car before it moved on to the next worker. In this way, the Ford Motor Company could build cars more quickly and easily, and it could sell them for much less money.
Before long, there were cars everywhere. All these cars created a need for better roads. Outside cities, most roads were made just of dirt. They were chokingly dusty in dry weather and impassably muddy in the rain. They were rough and full of holes. Few bridges connected roads across rivers and streams. America's new drivers demanded that these problems be fixed. So local and state governments began building and improving roads as they had never done before. As new roads were built, many new businesses opened along them. There were gasoline stations and auto repair shops, of course, but soon there were eating places and hotels where travelers could eat and sleep. In the 1920s, the United States was becoming a nation of car lovers.
Cars changed more than the way Americans traveled. They changed the way Americans lived. They removed some of the limitations of living conditions. For example, families with cars no longer had to live in noisy, crowded cities. They could live in suburbs, the wide open areas outside cities. They could use their car to drive to work in the city. Businesses moved too. No longer did they have to be close to railroad lines. With new cars and trucks, they could transport their goods where they wanted, when they wanted. They were no longer limited by train times. Cars also made life on farms less lonely. It became much easier for farm families to go to town on business or to visit friends.
Cars helped Americans learn more about their nation. In the 1920s, people could drive all across the land for not much money. Places that used to be days apart now seemed suddenly closer. Families that normally stayed home on weekends and holidays began to explore the country. They drove to the seashores and lakeshores, to the mountains and forests, to places of historical importance or natural beauty.
Not all the changes linked to the car were good, of course. Automobile accidents became more common and deadly. Other forms of transportation, such as railroads, began to suffer from the competition. Some railroads had to close down. Horses and wagons, once the most common form of transportation, began to disappear from city streets. There were not enough cars in the 1920s to cause severe air pollution, but the air was becoming less pure every year, and the roads were becoming more crowded and noisy.
The automobile greatly changed America's transportation. Radio greatly changed its communication. The first radio station opened in the state of Pennsylvania in 1920. Within 10 years, there were hundreds of others. There were more than 13 million radio receivers. Most of the radio stations were owned by large broadcasting networks. These networks were able to broadcast the same program to stations all over the country.
Most programs were simple and entertaining. There were radio plays, comedy shows, and music programs. But there also were news reports and political events. Millions of people who never read newspapers now heard the news on radio. Citizens everywhere could hear the president's voice. Like the automobile, radio helped bring Americans together. They were able to share many of the same events and experiences.
Radio also was a great help to companies. Businesses could buy time on radio programs for advertisements. In these ads, they told listeners about their products. They urged them to buy the products, cars, electric refrigerators, foods, medicines. In this way, companies quickly and easily created a nationwide demand for their goods. Automobiles and radios were not the only new technologies to change American life in the days after World War I. Still, one more invention would have a great effect on how Americans spent their time and money. That was the motion picture.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.